Okay, welcome. My name is Divine. This is episode 299 of the Divine Intervention Podcasts. And in this podcast, I'll be continuing the rapid review series for the USMLE Step 2 CK exam. This is going to be series 53. So let's just jump right into it. So what if they give you a question about like a 52-year-old male and he tells you that, you know, he has not been feeling well for the past like 2 weeks, right? And they tell you that his past medical history is notable for like hypertension and that, you know, he has been having low back pain for the last like month or whatever, and he started taking like naproxen every day. And then you notice that he has like some mild flank pain, and you know, they give you a bunch of labs and you notice that, you know, his potassium is a little high, his creatinine is like 2.3, and his BUN is elevated. What should you be thinking about? Well, I hope you're thinking about some kind of kidney injury, right, from the NSAID that he's taken, right? So remember, NSAIDs are very bad with causing a lot of kidney injuries, right? I mean, what exactly do they do? Because, again, our friends at the MBME, they've had this renewed focus in recent times on testing issues that relate to step one, right? So bringing step one material all the way down to step two CK, step three. The thing you want to think about is that NSAIDs, right? Remember, they inhibit cyclooxygenase. So if you inhibit cyclooxygenase, the thing that's going to happen is you're going to have less in the way of prostaglandins. And remember that prostaglandins are very powerful vasodilators, right? So if the vasodilatory effect is gone, you're going to have a net vasoconstriction of the afferent arterial, right? And when you constrict the afferent arterial, you're going to have less perfusion of the kidneys. You're going to have less hydrostatic pressures in the glomerular capillaries. And that's going to bring down, obviously, if the hydrostatic pressures go down, your GFR is going to go down. So your creatinine is going to go up, right? And remember, the reason that your potassium gets high in kidney disease is that people that have kidney disease of some sort, the potassium will not be able to be excreted. Remember, your kidneys are one of the primary excretory organs for potassium, right? So obviously in that case, and also remember, other than the afferent arterial effects, NSAIDs also have like a direct toxic effect on the tubules, on the renal tubules, right? So they can cause problems in those circumstances. Now, what if they give you a question about like a 16-year-old, you know, immigrant from Vietnam, right? And they tell you that this person, you know, has these episodes where he's like very short of breath. And then they give you like some labs and you notice that his hemoglobin is 8, right? 8 grams per deciliter, right? Obviously that's low. And then they also give you some story in the question about how this person's MCV is like 75, right? And then they ask, oh, what should be true of the EPO levels in this patient? Right. So obviously this person from Vietnam with a low hemoglobin and a low MCV, an MCV that's less than 80, you know, microcytic anemia, obviously has thalassemia. Right. So remember, if a person has thalassemia, right, again, they usually have that problem because they have issues with the synthesis. At least let's say we're dealing with like beta thalassemia, for example, they have issues with the synthesis of beta globin. Right. So because they have issues with the synthesis of beta globin, right, they're not going to be able to make hemoglobin, right? Because again, that's why their hemoglobin is low. Because remember, hemoglobin literally includes heme and globin, right? So if you have a globin deficiency, then there's nothing for heme to marry for you to form hemoglobin, right? So those people, right, like their red blood cells will be hemolyzed very commonly, right? They'll be exploding all the time. And if you keep exploding those people's red blood cells, right, like the way the body will try to respond is to say, you know what, let's try to see if we can make newer and newer and newer red blood cells, right? Because those people are going to be chronically hypoxic from having the low hemoglobin. Remember, when hemoglobin is low, that will reduce the oxygen content of your blood, right? And when the oxygen content of your blood goes down, the thing that's going to, because again, remember, that equation for hemoglobin is like your hemoglobin times your SaO2, right? Plus 1.34 mils, right, times your P little AO2, right? So like your amount of hemoglobin, your SaO2 and your P little AO2, those things all go into the oxygen content equation for your blood, right? So if the person's oxygen content of blood is low, right, that's going to trigger the release of EPO, right? EPO from the kidneys. And as they release more EPO from the kidneys, that's what's going to try to drive the bone marrow to produce more red blood cells. Although, if you really think about it, right, a person whenever a person has an anemia, right? Whenever a person has an anemia, it's actually very high yield to know that, because I think this is one thing that people kind of mess up on exams and it kind of screws them over. So let me maybe backtrack a little, right? Many people, you know, they try to memorize specific disorders and the effect on the reticulocyte count, right? But that's where you need to be careful. You don't even have to really memorize a lot of stuff. The thing is, reticulocytes are immature red blood cells, right? So the thing is, you will make immature red blood cells if you have the feedstock that is necessary for you to make those red blood cells, right? But the thing is, so there are certain anemias where you have enough to make red blood cells. The only reason you're anemic is because you are destroying the red blood cells at an accelerated rate. So for example, if a person has a kind of hemolytic anemia, right? So say for example, a person has like hereditary spherocytosis, right? Or a person has an autoimmune hemolytic anemia, right? In those circumstances, you are able to pump out as many red blood cells as you want. The only problem is that those red blood cells are being destroyed at an accelerated rate. And also, I guess in a person that has paroxysmal nocturnal hemoglobinuria, right? Those people all have anemias, but the reason that they have those anemias is because those red blood cells are being destroyed at an accelerated rate. So those people, because their body is like, oh, wow, these red blood cells, they're supposed to survive for 120 days, but because they can't live that long, let's go ahead and make more red blood cells. They have the feedstock. Everything is great. So those people's reticulocyte count will be high, right? Because the body is like, let's try to replenish these red blood cells, right? So they are pumping, right? So they don't have enough time to do like adequate amounts of quality control. So they produce all these reticulocytes, right? So in those circumstances, whenever you have an anemia from increased destruction, your retic count is going to be high, right? But if you have an anemia because you have decreased production of red blood cells, your reticulocyte count is going to be low, right? So for example, in thalassemia, if you really think about it, remember like in red blood cells, we have hemoglobin. We said in thalassemia, right, in all the thalassemias, you have a decrease in globin synthesis. So if you're looking at, again, hemoglobin has been made up of heme plus globin. If your globin is down, then your hemoglobin will be down. That's a decreased production anemia. So in thalassemia, the reticulocyte count is going to be low. That's a common misnomer amongst many medical students. They're like, oh, in thalassemia, the reticulocyte count is high. No, it's not. In thalassemia, the reticulocyte count is actually low. That's something that's floridly high yield to know for the purposes of your exam. And then another classic thing, right, that's all the classic things that cause the low retic count, right? Again, think about things like iron deficiency anemia. Again, if you think about it, if you actually want to make hemoglobin, right? Again, if you boil it down to this equation, you'll be pretty set for the most part. Again, if you're making hemoglobin, hemoglobin is made from what? From heme and globin. I mean, literally the name, hemoglobin, right? So heme and globin. And we know that heme is made from iron and protoporphyrin, right? So when a person has iron deficiency anemia, the thing that happens in people that have iron deficiency anemia is they literally have an iron deficiency, right? So if you have an iron deficiency, you're not going to be able to make heme. If you're not able to make heme, there's no marriage partner for globin. So you're going to have decreased hemoglobin synthesis. So those people are going to have a low retic count. Think about a person that has lead poisoning. If a person has lead poisoning, remember those people, lead inhibits ALA synthase and ferrochelatase, right? And those are key enzymes that are necessary for the synthesis of heme. So again, if you cannot make heme, then you cannot make hemoglobin. So your hemoglobin is low. So in lead poisoning, the retic count will be low. Or think about a person that has any of these heme pathway synthesis disorders, right? Like, although these are more, you know, like porphyria cutanea tarda or acute intermittent porphyria. Again, remember in acute intermittent porphyria, you have a deficiency of the enzyme that I like to call peanut butter and jelly deaminase, right? Porphobilinogen deaminase, right? For porphyria cutanea tarda, you have a deficiency of UROD, right? Uroporphyrinogen decarboxylase, right? If you have a deficiency of those things, again, you're not going to be able to make heme. If you're not able to make heme, then you're not going to be able to make hemoglobin, right? So that's a reduced production anemia. So the thing that's going to happen in those circumstances is that your retic count is going to be low, right? So again, hopefully this kind of clears things up for people. Because again, I feel like many people struggle with this retic count, but you don't have to struggle with it. if you just kind of understand this pathway that, oh, heme comes from iron plus protoporphyrin, and then that heme plus globin makes hemoglobin. If you have anything that is low along that pathway, that's going to crush your hemoglobin synthesis. Well, if you're not able to make hemoglobin, guess what? You're not going to be able to make red blood cells, right? You're not going to be able to make red blood cells. But again, many people, unfortunately, will then say, oh, divine. Okay. I like what you're saying right now. So that means any anemia that is associated with a low retic count, right, may be associated with a low ferritin. Well, guess what, folks? That's not true. Again, that's why many times on these exams, right? Again, that's one of the unfortunate things that has happened with this increased emphasis of the current generation on just memorizing things and not necessarily understanding them, right? The thing is, they then make like these, they know all these things. They can tell you every factoid known to man. But then you throw like a generic MBME question in front of them and their knowledge base completely falls apart, right? The reason that knowledge base is completely falling apart is, guess what? You don't have an actual understanding of pathophysiology, right? Because the thing is, if a person looks at iron deficiency anemia, right? The retic count is low. And we know why the retic count is low. Because again, you have low levels of iron, so you're not able to make heme because there's nothing to bind to protoporphyrin to make heme, right? So in iron deficiency anemia, obviously your iron stores will be low. So your ferritin is going to be low. If your ferritin is low, your TIBC is going to be high, right? And again, because you literally have an iron deficiency, your transferrin saturation is going to be low, right? But the thing is, if you look at lead poisoning, lead, yes, it inhibits ALE dehydratase, it inhibits ferrochelatase, so you're not able to make protoporphyrin. And because you're not able to make protoporphyrin, there is no marriage partner for iron for you to form heme. So because of that, the retic count is low. But the thing is, if you really understand lead poisoning, you see that, oh, it's protoporphyrin synthesis that is impaired. There's nothing wrong with iron synthesis. So, I mean, with iron, right? So guess what? Those people, it's almost like an iron overload state. Lead poisoning, to be honest with you, is almost like an iron overload state. So in people that have lead poisoning, guess what? Their ferritin is actually high. Their TIBC is actually low. And their transferrin saturation is actually high. Because they have a lot of iron around, but it's kind of like iron showed up for the wedding. But there's no protoporphyrin for iron to get married to for you to form heme. Right? So again, it's very high yield. Again, like that's the thing with these iron labs. Hematology is something that's a bear for many people. But heme is actually a relatively simple subject if you just understand like what in the world is going on. And to be honest with you, I did not plan to talk about all this stuff with iron and heme or whatever. But I'm just kind of like, yeah, this is probably something interesting to kind of talk about, right? That can, you know, kind of clear things up for people. Again, a lot of this stuff is in the understanding, not necessarily in how much you memorize. So again, don't get me wrong, for these USMLE exams, memorization is key, right? It's very important. But one thing you need to keep at the back of your mind is you also need to that memorization, add understanding, right? To that memorization, you need to add understanding. I mean, there's a reason why people use this term knowledge, understanding, and wisdom, right? When you memorize the facts, you are gaining knowledge, right? But the thing is, you got to understand that, because remember, wisdom is like when you practically apply the knowledge that you have understood, right? So if you memorize, the knowledge is there. But if there's no understanding, there's almost like a break in the pathway to wisdom, because you may not necessarily be able to, again, you can press all those threes in Anki all you want. But if you don't have the understanding, again, the MBME just needs to write a bunch of questions, especially with the newer exams, that will just make your knowledge base completely fall apart. Right? And you absolutely do not want to be in those kinds of circumstances, right? So since we're kind of talking about thalassemia, let's kind of talk about one thing I want to mention, right? So I don't know, I feel like today I'm just addressing many misnomers that people have from like med school or whatever, or from their studying, and then it ends up like hosing them on MBME exams, right? So one thing that kind of came to mind with thalassemias, right? So remember like alpha versus beta thalassemias, right? Remember, those are examples of hemoglobinopathies, right? So many times people that have, you know, many people take away this blanket statement that, oh, whenever a person has a hemoglobinopathy, usually the smart thing to do for those people in terms of diagnostic testing is to do hemoglobin electrophoresis. That's true for the most part, but guess what? That is not entirely true. That is absolutely not entirely true. Right? For example, if a person has beta thalassemia, well, if you look at the different kinds of hemoglobin, right? Remember, there is hemoglobin A, you know, the regular hemoglobin in humans, that's alpha 2, beta 2. There's hemoglobin A2, right, which is alpha 2, delta 2. There is hemoglobin F, which is alpha 2, gamma 2, right? So those are like the major hemoglobins that you find in human beings. Well, guess what? All those hemoglobins, there is at least one, actually there's two, that do not contain beta globin chains, right? So like hemoglobin F, which I said is alpha 2, gamma 2, and hemoglobin A2, which is alpha 2, delta 2. So guess what? If a person has a beta thalassemia, which is a decrease in beta globin gene synthesis, it would make sense that those other hemoglobins that do not contain beta chains would increase, right? So because it's like, oh, wow, one kind of hemoglobin would decrease. In this case, hemoglobin A, that's alpha 2, beta 2. But another kind of hemoglobin would increase. In this case, hemoglobin F, that's alpha 2, gamma 2, and hemoglobin A2, that's alpha 2, delta 2, right? You can observe those relative differences on hemoglobin electrophoresis. But think about it. If a person has alpha thalassemia, look at all the hemoglobins I just literally rammed out, right? Hemoglobin A, alpha 2, beta 2. Hemoglobin A2, alpha 2, delta 2. Hemoglobin F, alpha 2, gamma 2. Guess what? All those hemoglobins, at least the major hemoglobins that we talk about in the human world, right? All contain alpha chains. So if all of them contain alpha chains, all of them will reduce proportionally in a person that has alpha thalassemia. So guess what? Alpha thalassemia cannot be diagnosed with hemoglobin electrophoresis. If a person has alpha thalassemia on your exam and you choose hemoglobin electrophoresis as a diagnostic test, you will get the question wrong, right? You will get the question wrong. And again, it's not like some strange random concept I'm explaining. It actually makes a lot of sense if you just really, really understand the pathophysiology, right? So hemoglobin electrophoresis is something you use when like there's a differential between the different kinds of hemoglobins that you can observe clinically, right? So again, if there's no differential as you see in alpha thalassemia, then hemoglobin electrophoresis is absolutely not the right thing to do, right? Now, one other question that your friends at the MBME could ask you on an exam is, what is the biggest risk factor for diastolic heart failure, right? What is the biggest risk factor for diastolic heart failure, right? Again, let's kind of work our way backwards here. We know that diastolic heart failure is the heart failure that is classically called heart failure with preserved ejection fraction. And let me say this, because again, some people can take that name as gospel, and then they begin to run into some, you know, sad, unpleasant circumstances on MBME exams. That preserved ejection fraction, think of it as an ejection fraction that is 40% or higher. So I'll say this, a person can have an ejection fraction of 45% on an MBME exam and still have heart failure with preserved ejection fraction. Again, I know many people kind of fall for that, but again, you don't need to fall for that if you're paying attention with all I'm saying in this podcast, right? So remember, in diastolic heart failure, right, those people, again, they have a preserved ejection fraction. Again, my definition that I'll say you should take away from this podcast for MBME purposes is an EF of 40% or higher, right? And again, there'll be many other parts of the question that will lead you towards that, right? So diastolic heart failure or preserved ejection fraction, that's something that usually happens to people that have a long-term history of an increased pressure overload on the left ventricle, right? So again, if you put a lot of pressure on, if the left ventricle has to contract against a lot of resistance, you'll say, you know what, for me to be able to generate adequate amounts of contractility, let me go ahead and get bigger and beefier, right? So you get bigger and beefier by adding sarcomeres in parallel. When you add sarcomeres in parallel, guess what? Yes, you'll be able to, you know, give like a very good squeeze for the blood in the left ventricle, right? But if you really think about it, as you get bigger and beefier, there's so much muscle in the way that the cavity size of the left ventricle goes down. So you're not able to fill with adequate amounts of blood. If you're not able to fill with adequate amounts of blood, the sad thing that's going to happen is that, yes, you can contract well, but if you're contracting like 50% of like 100 mils instead of like 50% of like 500 mils as you did before, then obviously your stroke volume is going to go down. So your cardiac output is going to go down and the person is going to become symptomatic, right? So the big question then you can ask yourself is, okay, so what's the biggest risk factor for like chronic pressure overload on the left ventricle? Well, it's going to be hypertension, right? So it actually makes sense that the biggest risk factor for diastolic hypertension, for diastolic heart failure, right, or heart failure with preserved ejection fraction, is a history of chronic hypertension. So I want to try to keep this around 20 minutes. So I'm going to go ahead and stop here. Again, as I do at the end of every podcast, I do offer one-on-one tutoring for many exams: Step 1, Step 2 CK, Step 3, preclinical med school exams, third-year shelf exams. And again, if you also need tutoring, if you're a medicine resident, I need tutoring for internal medicine entering exam or your internal medicine boards, I do offer tutoring for that as well. And then again, I have a step 2 CK/step 3 class coming up from the 28th of April to the 1st of May. Again, we're going to cover a ton of stuff that's extremely high yield for the exam that covers things that also include the new changes that started last year. And again, we're also going to cover a lot of biostats, a lot of ethics, right? Again, it's very comprehensive. It's 20 hours, 5 hours each day. And then on the 27th of April, I have like an MBME test taking strategies class. Again, tons of people have taken that class. They found it to be extremely helpful. And then please subscribe to the website, divineinterventionpodcast.com. If I make a new podcast, you'll get an email notification. And then I have these podcasts on Apple Podcasts, on Google Podcasts, and on Spotify. So again, if you subscribe to those, again, you can get those updates. And then also my videos are on my YouTube channel, Divine Intervention, USMLE Podcasts and Videos, right? So if you want to sign up for any of these classes, just go ahead and shoot me an email through the website, and I'll be more than happy to give you some more information on cost and times and all those things. And I'll be happy to point you in the right direction. So thank you for listening to this podcast. I'll see you next time. God bless you and stay strong.